You're listening to The Record on KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds.
And I'm David Hyde. And 56 years ago today, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. Gary Heide used to teach in the Highline School District in West Seattle, and he remembers that day well. At the time, he was one of a handful of white students at Lincoln College in Jefferson City, Missouri. It's the oldest black college west of the Mississippi River. Gary enrolled there to avoid the draft for the Vietnam War, and in the early spring of 1968, Gary's theater professor, Dr. Pauly, asked him a question.
Gary, do you know about our speech association? And I said, you mean the National Speech Association? And he said, no. He said, when the National Speech Association was formed back in the 30s, none of the black universities were invited. So we formed our own association. And our association meeting is at Kentucky State College in Frankfort, Kentucky. And it's coming up in a few weeks. And I want you to be one of the representatives from Lincoln. There'll be five other students and you, and there'll be me and one other sponsor. Would you want to do that? And I said, of course, I'd love to do that. So we took off in a couple of weeks. We took off early in the morning. It was a long drive. It was about a five-hour drive from Jefferson City to Frankfort. And we stopped along Interstate 70 to get something to eat at Nickerson Farms. And if you're not from the Midwest, you would not know Nickerson Farms, but they were huge red roofed barn kind of restaurants and kind of family style. So we stopped. And I mean, this is 1968. So there's, you know, there are looks, particularly when I walk in with all these black students and black sponsors. I mean, people were staring at me like, why are you with them? And I just let it roll off and really didn't pay any attention to it. And we had a wonderful time. And so anyway, we took off and we got to Frankfort, Kentucky. And Dr. Pauly dropped us off at the dorm. We had to check into the dorm, and he just kind of disappeared. He said, you know, this is what you do, and this is where you go, and then he disappeared. So we moved into the dorm, and then we went over to the cafeteria, and then we went over to the registration, and we were there about 20 minutes, and the lines were long, and kids were coming in from every major black university and college. There were over 500 black students, and then me, which I kind of loved, actually. I mean, I kind of loved being the only one. And we were there about 20 minutes waiting in line, and a girl came running into the lobby and screamed, "They've killed Martin." And it was total silence. I mean, it was a gasp. It was, I mean, you could literally feel the energy in the room just totally shifted. And so people ran to phones. There was a phone bank. And I was standing next to a professor from Memphis State, and I decided to call home. And I got my wife on the phone, and she said, oh, have you heard? There's all kinds of things going on. They killed Martin Luther King, and there are all kinds of riots breaking out. What's going on there? And I said, well, and already the old gymnasium had been set on fire, so there was smoke in the air. And my wife was pregnant, and I thought, well, the last thing I'm going to do is get her upset. So I just basically said, you know, people are really upset, but, you know, it's okay. And right at that moment, I heard this professor in the next phone say, what do you mean there are tanks in our yard? You mean tanks? And he grabbed his chest and literally just crumbled and died right next to me. And his students were all standing around him. I'd never experienced anything like it. The students that I was with were just in a panic. I mean, it's not like any of us had ever been in a riot. So they grabbed me and they said, Gary, we need to tell you this. When we first got here and we stopped at the dorm, students were already a little upset that you were going to be staying in the dorm. So I think we need to get out of here. I think we need to find Dr. Pauly. Let's go back to the dorm. Let's get the clothes and let's get out of town. So we started to walk out of the lobby, and this kid saw me and he said, I hope for your sake a black man did it. The kids I was with just grabbed me and said, come on, come on, come on. So we're walking and the air is filled with smoke, and this hot rod drives by where we are near the sidewalk, and this big redneck, redheaded kid sticks his head out, and he's got a sign, a cardboard sign, and on it it says, the coon is dead. Long live the coon. And suddenly, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I couldn't believe what I was reading. And he had this big grin on his face, and I screamed something that I cannot repeat on the radio. And right behind that car was another car chasing that car. And in it was, there was a really tall African-American. He looked like he was maybe even beyond college age, but he was about 6'4", and he had a giant afro that just about filled up the window. And he spotted me and pointed at me, and he said, "You honky, you're going to die tonight." And the kids that I was with just grabbed me, just kind of surrounded me, you know, made a donut of humanity around me. And we walked back to the dorm. And we got into the dorm room, and we had a quick meeting. First, we sent Stephen McKinley Henderson out. Stephen was from Kansas City. And he just said, "You know, I've got to get hold of Dr. Pauly. We have to get out of here." So he went off to call Dr. Pauly, and the rest of us decided, what are we going to do? And somebody said, "Well, let's sneak Gary down the back stairwell and we'll pull a car up. And then, Gary, you crawl into the car so no one sees you and get on the floorboard. We'll cover you with clothes. We'll bring all of our clothes down and then we'll hop in and we'll put our feet on top of you. We'll sit in the back and we'll get out of here." And Stephen comes rushing into the room right then, and his nose is smashed all over his face and blood is just gushing down him. And what had happened is he was very light-skinned, and he said, "We've got to get Gary out of here now. They thought I was white, and they jumped me, and they're going to kill him." So we did what we said. We got down the back stairwell. I got into the car. They covered me with clothes, and we started to pull out of the parking lot, and right then a pickup drove by in front of the dorm, and a guy with a rifle shot three times into the dorm and, of course, you know, broke out windows. And instantly about 300 really angry young black men came pouring out of that dorm carrying baseball bats, picking up bricks and rocks, looking for a suspect who shot into our dorm. And of course, you know, I would have been a fairly likely person. However, I was still on the floorboard covered in clothes, and kids were so frightened. We couldn't move the car. I mean, there were 300 people suddenly just all around us all the way up to the road, and we couldn't drive without running over somebody. So we're inching along, and kids are trying to get in our car. They're scared. They want to go somewhere. Are we leaving? Can we go with you? The students I was with was like, "Get out of here, get out of here." And they were rolling up the window and we locked the doors. We finally got on the road. And by then, cars that were driving by were getting pelted with bricks and smashed with baseball bats. And we didn't know what to do because we couldn't find Dr. Pauly. So we drove down the road and we went about a mile away from Kentucky State. And we pulled into the first motel we could find. And it wasn't a great looking motel, but it was handy. And we pulled in, and somebody said, "You know, until we find him, we might as well just get a room because we can't sit in the car." So we got a room, and we went up into the room, and Cecil Doty, who was from L.A., he turned on the TV, and he said, "Look," he said, "that's L.A., that's where I'm from, it's on fire," you know, and there was Detroit and Atlanta and, you know, all the major cities were being covered by the news, and they were all on fire. And then he turned to Channel 6 in Frankfurt, and he said, "Look, there's a whole gang of people. There must be 200 or 300 people, and they're carrying torches, and they're walking down the hill." And he said, "Oh, my God," he goes, "that's our motel. They're walking in here." And sure enough, they're pouring, turning the corner. They're coming into the parking lot of the motel, and it's very obvious that they're going to burn down our motel. So he runs to the window, flings open the curtain, and starts waving, and this little speck on the TV, you can see Cecil Doty waving, and we said, "What are we going to do? I mean, they really are going to burn down this motel." And as we're pondering our fate, two vehicles pull into the parking lot right in the middle of this gang of people, and there were four Klansmen in each car, and they each had either a rifle or a shotgun. And the crowd just disperses, starts screaming and running. And I mean, nobody wants to get shot. And so a lot of them are heading toward this little restaurant right on the edge of the parking lot. And the owner of the restaurant sees what's going on. So he locks the door, and kids are banging on the windows and yanking on the door and trying to get into this restaurant because they're terrified they're going to get shot. And somebody throws a brick and it breaks out the window, and it was just a nightmare. I mean, it was just a nightmare, but at least the motel did not burn to the ground. And so we're there that evening, and other students from the conference also moved into this motel. And some of the students were discovering that homeboys and homegirls from Philadelphia or places that they were from were also in the motel. And here, you know, everybody's in shock and everybody's horrified at the events, April the 4th, 1968. And I think in order to cope, partying began. And I'm sitting there thinking how odd this was. And the door, people were going in and out of our room, and the door swung open, and who should walk by but the 6'4" African-American who had this huge afro. And he started to walk by the room, and he turned and saw me sitting there. And then he stopped, just kind of frozen, and he started toward the door. And I can't remember who it was now that slammed the door in his face and locked it. And we moved a heavy piece of furniture, and he was screaming, "Why are you in there with him? Why are you hanging out with him? He's responsible for this." And my friends were saying, "He didn't do anything. You know, he's a good guy. He's with us." I'm sitting over in the corner on the floor while all of this is going on. And instead of getting really terrified, I just kind of gave myself over to the fact that if I didn't make it through the night, I wouldn't make it through the night. The other students were so freaked out by this guy banging on the door that nobody else went in and out of the room for the rest of the night. We kept the door locked and somehow made it through the night until we could get hold of Dr. Polly, who showed up the next morning. And Dr. Polly was this very straight-laced man who always wore beautiful suits and beautiful ties. He was always extremely, you know, buttoned down. And he showed up in his Buick and pulled into this glass-filled, brick-filled parking lot. And we came out, we hurried out, and he got that look, that professorial look that he could get. And he said, "I certainly hope none of you people were involved in any of this." And we said, "Dr. Polly, get in the car and drive, and we'll tell you what went on here." I mean, he'd been hanging out with some college buds and really just had no intention of being involved with us at all while we were there. And he realized what would have happened had something happened to us on his watch or his lack of watch. So on the way back, we stopped at Nickerson Farms because we'd had such a nice meal before. And we're walking across the parking lot, and the parking lot's filled with people, and you can see people eating in the restaurant. And we get up to the door, and just as we get to the door, lock right in my face. And I'm yanking on the door, and I said, I know they're open. I mean, they're open all the time. And I started banging on the door, and finally this kind of surly-looking man opened the door, cracked it open, and he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "We want to come in and eat." And he said, "Well, you can come in, but they can't." And, I mean, even after I'd been through all of this, I still couldn't believe that here in this public restaurant that we'd had a wonderful meal 24 hours before, we couldn't come into because of what had just happened. So when I got back home, as I was reflecting on the events, I really felt like I was blessed. And I know that sounds a little strange, but I thought to myself, what would happen if every white guy and woman in America could have the experience that I just had? To be the only one, you know, surrounded by people that didn't look like you. I realized that if I felt that much tension from one day of being different, being the odd man out, being the minority, what would it be like to live like that in a country that viewed you not as a person, not as an equal, assuming that because of the color of your skin that they actually know something about you, that they know what you're like, that they know how intelligent you are, that they have any idea of what you've been through in life, stereotyping you based on race. And so I felt like I had gotten one of the most important parts of my education at Kentucky State College, what race in America really means, what it's like to be in the minority. And what I went through was nothing compared to what it must be like daily. I used what I learned from that experience about not assuming that I know anything about somebody based on the color of their skin when I became a teacher. So in the classroom, that lesson came back daily, thinking that, you know, okay, well, you're black and you live in this area and your dad's in jail and this has happened, but I don't know anything about you. I don't know you. And in order for me to get to know you, I have to do just that. I can't assume anything about you. And it was an invaluable lesson.
Gary Heide, a teacher in the Highline School District in West Seattle. That story was produced by Jeannie Yandel. You're listening to The Record on KUOW.